This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe filmmaker and art historian James Crump. His new documentary is Troublemakers, The Story of Land Art, which opens this Friday, January 15th, at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Art, here in Santa Fe. James Crump will be here in person for the 7 o'clock screening on Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. It was a pleasure to watch this movie. It's a documentary about land art and the very interesting circle of artists from that era that began in the 1960s and really continues to the present day. First of all, for our listeners who might not be familiar with this whole movement, what is land art?
Well, land art in this instance, because I hew very closely to the period between 1968 and 1973, are artists who were primarily based in New York City who were, for one reason or another, responding to the zeitgeist of the times, responding to the current art market of that period of time. And what they were trying to do was to break free from the limitations of traditional painting and sculpture, the European tradition of easel painting and sculptural objects on plinths, etc. So they were trying to break free from these limitations by doing monumental works out in the open landscape into the desert being a site for most of the iconic works because there was space there. There was enormous amounts of space and light, and it was their effort to go out into these places and create these awe-inspiring works.
It's interesting that, I mean, there were these multiple strains, one of them being the rejection of commercialism of the gallery system, the museum system. Why did some of these artists want to reject that system in the first place?
It's not a complete rejection, I would say. And also there's a lot of contradictions in land art in terms of the intention and in terms of the efforts themselves. So there's contradiction insofar as they are challenging, they have a healthy critique of commodification. But that's also wrapped up with what was happening politically and socially at the time. The Vietnam War, for instance, the political assassinations, the student movements, both here in North America and in Europe. So they're responding to various things, and the gallery aspect is just part of a larger, what they, I think, considered, not collectively, but on their each of their own terms, as a kind of oppressive system that they were rejecting and pushing back. And I think the traditional ways of making and showing art were being critiqued by these artists because they felt that those ways were worn out and were tired and were ready for renewal and redefinition.
There was a gallery owner named Virginia Dwan who was very supportive. We hear a lot from her in the film, and from her perspective, she really looked at this whole idea of having a much larger canvas on which to make art. So, like, instead of a canvas that might cover even a large wall, which seems monumental on an artistic scale, you might have a square mile of earth. Talk more about the feeling of that, the attraction of working on that scale, and how they did it.
Well, the ambition was such that these were works that couldn't be displayed in a traditional museum or gallery context. That's what she's getting at. The Southwest was appealing because it's one of the most unique parts of the world where you actually have these large, immense spaces that are very, very, very remote and allow for this kind of intervention by the artist. And so that was appealing. And I think also the light, actually, the light is so particular, as you know, in the American Southwest, particularly in New Mexico and Arizona, that was also something that appealed to them because of the perceptive aspects of some of these works. But it really has to do with resources of space. I think if you ask, for instance, Michael Heiser, he's not going to Nevada just because it's the desert, because it's some romantic notion of the desert. He's actually trying to build and redefine sculpture, and that's where he could do it. And so you have to look at each artist on a case-by-case basis to understand what drove them, what inspired them to go to these places. For Walter DeMaria in the Lightning Field in New Mexico, it had to do with finding the perfect site where he could manifest his vision for this piece, which is really about perception. And in order for the viewer to actually enjoy this work, you have to commit yourself first to a long drive, you know, an amazing drive through the desert. And then you are confined to this space for, you know, 18, 20 hours, where you're forced to slow down and forced to respond to the work. And I think that he found the perfect site, much like Heiser found. I think he was brilliant in citing double negative about 2 hours from Las Vegas, Nevada.
I mean, there's a kind of irony here in the sense that, I mean, this is work that many of us will never experience firsthand. We'll experience it through photographs or in a film like yours, these huge works in places like Nevada or southern New Mexico, whatever. And in fact, in art galleries where we might see, or places like the CCA. But describe to us some of your experiences, because as an art historian and as a filmmaker and as a documentarist doing this film, you have gone to see a lot of this work. I was wondering if you could sort of describe your own experience of some of these pieces, Michael Heiser's work or Walter DiMaria or Robert Smithson.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to point out that photography is a very contradictory and contentious element in the history of land art. There are many, many contradictions for its use and for it being renounced as a way to record or to document the works. And I also point out, whenever I talk about the film, is that you'll never replace the visceral viewing experience with a film or with a photograph. There's just nothing that will replace that feeling of actually visiting the sites. To talk about one site, for instance, Double Negative in rural Nevada, it's a brilliantly sited mesa for this work. You have to make a great effort to get there, but once you do, it's very, very rewarding because you're in this incredibly remote place and you don't sense any urban context whatsoever, even though you're not so far away from a small village nearby, and even the interstate runs not too far away through the desert there. But when you're on top of that mesa, you feel that you're so far away. And as I said about Lightning Field, perception becomes acute and things slow down and you begin to perceive the most subtle things. It's this huge dome of sky that meets the horizon that you can see for miles and miles on a clear day. And so they're very, very, that's a very special site, as the other ones are. And I would describe the other sites very similarly in terms of going there, spending time and besting yourself outside of the city or the urban context to perceive and to sense and to, I think also what these pieces do is they remind you how insignificant, you know, one is to the cosmos, for example, and how small we are as living beings in this, you know, this larger matrix of space and time.
Yeah, it's funny because it brings up kind of almost like a paradox for me, which is that on the one hand, these works remind you of how very small you are. And on the other hand, there's a kind of, at least to me, almost kind of like a hubris about land art. The idea that you can go in there and change and perhaps improve on natural space like a mesa. Especially in the context of the fact that so much of the hand of man here in the desert Southwest has really been destructive. And I wondered if there was conversation along those lines about hubris and about destruction with respect to land art.
I don't think I would use such a strong term as hubris, although there's moments when all these artists are hubristic. I think that in the case of Smithson, for instance, I think he was very engaged with creating a piece where nature performs from the very outset. He was very interested in entropy and decay, and he was very aware that at some point nature would reclaim Spiral Jetty, which is what's happening presently. It goes through cycles where right now it's enduring its, you know, the greatest drought in the Great Salt Lake, but a few years, not that long ago, it was submerged where there was more water. So I think he wasn't trying to necessarily improve on nature, but he was trying to work with nature and embracing the power of nature. And he says this in statements and in writings. He actually talks about how most people don't have a really a very accurate sense of the power of nature. He says most people have a Disneyland sense of nature, but I don't think Bob Smithson did.
Yeah.
And same with Michael Heiser. He wasn't necessarily trying to improve. I think also his intention was to make something that, you know, eventually would last a very long time. But, you know, if you look at that work today, the Double Negative, you see how much erosion has taken place and how that Mesa is indeed reclaiming the work. And unless there is intervention, it will eventually go away through the harsh conditions of the desert, the changes in temperature and the climate itself.
I wanted to ask you about Robert Smithson and his work. Spiral Jetty is at the Great Salt Lake in Utah, one of the most famous land art pieces of all. And I found it fascinating that some of your commentators in the film said that Smithson seemed to be drawing on the dark forces, quote unquote. One person called him satanic. Another person said he was insane. Yet the work seems so connected to nature and to natural geometries. How do you see Smithson and his work and this whole business about kind of insanity and dark forces?
Well, I think when Carl Andre talks about Smithson being engaged with the dark forces, what he's talking about is Smithson's very long engagement and fascination with dystopian narratives, the apocalypse. As I said earlier, he's interested in entropy and decay. He's interested in the artifacts of civilization. He writes about it a lot. He alludes to it. He's very, very engaged with these ideas and these notions of historic time and of the possible end of the earth. And that's what Carl Andre is saying. I don't think he literally means Smithson was insane. I think what he meant was Robert Smithson had no thresholds, and he was someone who was unpredictable and incredibly intense and very, let's just say, intense in his conversations about all of these things. And if you talk to anybody who met Smithson or hung out with him, they would describe him similarly. I think that he's not talking about someone being really demented. He's talking about someone who's just far out, and someone who's out there in his thoughts was very prescient and very, very progressive and was very, very aware of what was happening in politics, in the social realms, certainly in the aesthetic realms. He was an avid reader and very involved with, when I say dystopian narrative, some of that comes from his fascination with science fiction and with popular culture, with, you know, B-movies, and even with darker aspects of New York City, like Times Square, for instance, in the late 60s. So that's what he's talking about, that there's a darkness and there's an awareness of the brevity of life. There's an awareness of the potential for death. I think that's what Virginia Dewan says about Smithson more than anyone, is that he was very aware of his own death, and he was using that element of death in his own work.
We're talking to James Crump about his film Troublemakers, The Story of Land Art. Why did you call the film Troublemakers?
Well, early on in the film, there's an interview with Germano Celant, who's a great art historian, Italian art historian, who in many ways adopted these American artists in his program of making exhibitions and books and so forth in the late 60s. He calls them troublemakers, and I thought it was very apt. So we chose that title, and I think it holds in terms of the critique they were making, their outsized ambitions, their desire to shake things up, as it were. And so I felt that troublemakers was a very apt term for the title.
What was the circle of artists like? Did they know each other? Were they supportive of each other, competitive, some of both?
Oh, yes, both. They were all very aware of each other, and some of them were at one point or another very close with each other, friends. And then, you know, there are rivalries that emerge and friendships are dissolved. But there was mutual respect. I think you have to really note that they were working individually. They weren't working collectively. They were all working toward their own manifestation of a vision. It wasn't something that they were trying to call it a movement, actually, is probably inaccurate. But in art history, we have to have these handles to put on things in order to better understand them. But they certainly were not working together or collectively, but individually. And so there were strong friendships, but there were also, I think, very strong rivalries, some of which exist today.
There was only one woman among them in the film. That was Nancy Holt, Robert Smithson's wife, who went on to have a very interesting career after Smithson died in a plane crash. He died very young. I think he was like 35 years old. Why do you think there were so few women doing this kind of work?
There were other women doing work in the desert at the time, and well, nearly that moment of the period that we hew closely to in the film. Nancy Holt was very, very integral to Bob Smithson's practice. I interviewed a number of people, including close friends and art historians who knew her during the time. And it's accurate what Lawrence Weiner says in the film, which is, you know, she was very much involved with the conversation, but she eventually finds her own practice later. And it was actually Robert Smithson who said, actually just before he died, in a very prophetic statement, something to the effect that it's now Nancy's turn. It's now Nancy's turn to go out and to do some of these very ambitious projects. And he died shortly thereafter. So I think when we talk about the artists working this period, we have to look at how I organize the film, which is to say those artists who were supported by Virginia Dewan and Heiner Friedrich, those are the artists I really wanted to deal with in the film. And those are the characters that we feature. It's not that we are trying to omit or overlook other, you know, other artists who happen to be female, but that's actually the milieu that we were dealing with, in the sense that those are the artists that Virginia Dewan and Heiner Friedrich greatly supported.
As I was watching the film, I was thinking about, and you show pictures of Stonehenge in the film, and I was also thinking about the Nazca lines and other examples of kind of monumental land art from the ancient past. How do you, I mean, are these artists working in some ways in the same spirit of some of these ancient works? How do you think about them together?
Well, I think they were, most of these artists were very fascinated and very knowledgeable, to some extent, knowledgeable about some of the ancient sites. Certainly, Michael Heiser was. His father was a renowned archaeologist and had been on major digs in the Americas, you know, Bolivia and in Mexico, elsewhere. Smithson, of course, as is pointed out in the film, spends time in the Yucatan and for years was interested in Mesoamerican civilization. So they're aware of it. You have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. Some of them are responding more strongly to actual sites, I think, or to the kinds of architecture that you find in the ancient Americas. And, you know, if you look at, for instance, at Star Axis, you know, it's very much about pieces about the North Star. It deals with star geometry that goes back, you know, millennia. And Charles Ross was very fascinated by it, and that's what the impetus was for that work. So yes, they're very aware, they're fascinated, and they're responding to some of these great sites that had been published and discussed historically.
Talk about the making of the film. How did you come to make it, and how did you gather all this material together? It's really just a beautifully made and crafted film.
Well, thank you. The film gestated for a very long time. I did an interview with Michael Heiser in 2003, and that essentially is when I began to think about doing something larger with this subject matter as a film. It only took 13 months once we started shooting footage and visiting sites and compiling the material. So the production time was rather short one, and we worked fast because I felt that the film needed to be seen as soon as possible for a variety of reasons. Some of the artists are no longer with us, others are aging, and I also felt that the film was something I wanted to share with a younger generation of artists because of the kind of highly commodified, hyper-speculative contemporary art market that we have today. I felt that the spirit of land art and decommodification and aspects like this would be worth rediscovering, worth sharing with a younger generation of artists who are beginning to form their own practices now.
Very interesting. James Crump is an art historian and filmmaker. The documentary is called Troublemakers, The Story of Land Art. It opens this Friday, January 15th at the CCA here in Santa Fe. And you will be here in person for the screening doing a Q&A after the film. Is that correct?
That's correct. I will be. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we look forward to having you here. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.